This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Shell. So today we are interviewing Bruce Smith. He's a wildlife biologist who's now retired from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Bruce has authored 5 nonfiction books of science, natural history, and outdoor adventure. Currently, he's writing novels with environmental themes for middle grade children. The third book in his Legend Keepers trilogy will be released in August. Some of Bruce's earlier books focused on conservation and management of mountain goats and elk, as well as on his adventures studying wildlife in the mountains of the West. So, Bruce, welcome. It's great to be talking to you again. We talked a couple of years ago, I think, about mountain goats, and so we're going to expand our conversation today. Welcome. Well,
thanks for inviting me, John.
So when we previously interviewed, we talked about mountain goats for the most part. So what have you been up to lately? What's going on?
Well, most of my time is spent writing still and doing environmental education.
Okay. Your last nonfiction book was a collection of essays titled Stories from a Field. What was that book about?
That book was a selection of what I would call entertaining stories that immerse readers in outdoor adventures. Adventures that I had and over the course of my life. Some of them are humorous. Some of them are harrowing, but they're true stories, experiences that I had as a naturalist and a sportsman and a wildlife biologist.
How wide-ranging were you geographically in with those stories?
Pretty wide-ranging. The one in eastern U.S., actually Michigan, where I grew up, takes place when I was a 7-year-old catching a monstrous snapping turtle. And but then there's stories from Montana, California, Wyoming, a story from South Africa, and one from the jungles of Vietnam.
You've really been around, haven't you? I think I saw that you once worked on the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming. What were you doing there?
I was the first wildlife biologist hired to work with the 2 tribes that share the reservation. That was back in 1978. So there was a fisheries biologist there, but I was the first wildlife biologist and was there at the invitation of the Shoshone and Arapaho tribes to serve as an advisor to them, do wildlife and habitat inventory, and develop a wildlife management plan for the reservation.
What was your favorite story from in the book, Stories from a Field?
Oh, gosh. That's a hard one. There's 16 stories. They're all true stories, essays. And, you know, all of them are interesting in their own way. About half of them transport readers into a field biologist world, traveling by foot, horseback, helicopter, into some of America's greatest landscapes. Just to give you kind of an overview, if you haven't read it, there's a story about a cookie-munching pack horse that I had a wreck with. Her near misses with lightning that I described that I've had. Another story is about being caught in an avalanche back in the wilderness by myself. Story about capturing hundreds of newborn elk calves for some of my research, stalking mountain goats on cliffs in the winter, being stranded in a helicopter and snowbound in the middle of January, 12 miles from the closest house. And being treed by a bear for about a half hour. So there's quite a variety.
Sounds great. So one of your other books was Wildlife on the Wind, about your time working with 2 Plains Indian tribes in Wyoming. So was that the Wind River Reservation experience?
Right. That's what I was just mentioning before, working with the Shoshone and Arapaho tribes.
And you wrote, I saw you wrote an article about a mountain lion in your driveway. What was that about?
Well, that was just a personal experience. When my wife Diane and I moved to Bozeman, we ended up finding, after a lot of looking, finding a lot that's kind of on the wildlife urban interface.
Uh-huh.
And of course, as people keep moving into lands that were previously undeveloped, we come into contact with wildlife more and more. And so I shared in that article some experiences we had and the importance of being respectful to the wildlife that we share the land with, because they were here first, and also the importance of keeping wildlife wild and what it requires to do that.
You wrote an article for Big Sky Journal called Empty Forests. What were you conveying there?
That was an article based upon, as you know, from when we've talked before, John, I was the biologist at the National Elk Refuge in Wyoming for 22 years. And some of my work there was to document condition of the habitat and changes that were occurring. In fact, my first book was a result of that, the changes that had happened over the 100-year history of the National Elk Refuge, which was established in 1912. And so this article refers to not only the changes that took place in habitat, but what the consequences of that were for wildlife populations, biodiversity, and so forth. And so I kind of walk readers through what it means when habitats are degraded and fragmented, not only for that particular area, but for the wider area, because they may be seasonal ranges, they may be migration routes, that sort of thing. So that's what it focuses on.
So there have been a lot of problems at the elk refuge with disease affecting the elk and having them concentrated together in the winter. What's your take on that?
Well, as I said, I was there for 22 years, so I got some personal view of what happens when you crowd 7,000 or 8,000 elk into a relatively small area for 6 months each year. The habitat degradation is one. For example, we were able to document from old photographs and so forth that 95% of the tall willow community has disappeared from the National Elk Refuge. And we looked at all of the potential causes for that, from weather and fire and historic livestock grazing, because much of it was private lands. But it became apparent that the changes in those willow communities were from chronic overgrowsing by elk. And likewise with aspen, there's 143 aspen stands on the refuge, and half of those are in poor and declining condition, because as the old trees die off and fall down, aspen don't live very long. The individual stems, the suckers that come up to replace them are browsed each winter and don't become trees. So that was one of the things that we looked at. But you mentioned disease, and you know, it's kind of like children in a daycare center. When you pack animals or people together, there's a high probability that diseases will spread more readily.
So would you like to see the elk refuge closed and the elk allowed to roam as they want?
Oh, no. I mean, the National Elk Refuge is one of our national treasures. It's a wonderful piece of habitat, 25,000 acres right there in the Jackson Hole Valley. And, you know, if it were closed, so to speak, and then there wasn't a need seen for it for the purpose for which it was established, who knows, maybe it would end up being sold off and subdivided, and that's the last thing Jackson Hole needs. There's more of that. It's a wildlife paradise for lots of species. It just doesn't support, other than the elk, as many species and abundance of those as it could. So you know, there's no doubt, I've made no bones about the fact, both when I was there and since then in my writing and speaking, that the feeding program needs to be phased out.
Mm.
But a lot of people think you can just close the feeding and that'll take care of it. But that would actually create more problems than it would solve, because there are too many animals for the available habitat, and there'd be tremendous backlash from just stopping the feeding. Animals would disperse onto private lands, and in a really bad winter like this previous winter, there would be an unusual amount of mortality. So what has to happen are the populations of the number of elk there have to be reduced in concert with the habitat carrying capacity, and then the feeding can be phased out as the animals are in balance for the habitat that's available there.
Well, are they somehow herded into the refuge from the forest, or how do they congregate to get a crowd of 7,000?
Yeah, they come from the Bridger-Teton National Forest, many of them from the Gros Ventre Wilderness and the Teton Wilderness, but half of the elk on the refuge actually summer in Grand Teton Park and then migrate to the refuge. And others, maybe 20% now, somewhere in the southern part of Yellowstone and migrate 60, 70 miles down to the elk refuge.
Mm.
Probably some of the longest elk migrations on the continent that remain.
Well, I know the what you really would like to talk about are the Legend Keepers novels that you've been working on. So you've previously published two, and you have the third in the works, about to be published. So what got you started on that project?
Yeah, this is what I do really want to talk about. And it's been really a wonderful switch from writing nonfiction and, you know, talking on more serious topics, switching from writing nonfiction to fiction. And I'd never written fiction, and I'd never written for children. But how this came about, John, is when I was doing a book tour for my nonfiction book, Life on the Rocks, A Portrait of the Mountain Goat. I was on the road for about, I think, 17 or 18 days, hit 12 or 15 venues, had one or two talks every day, and I was just struck that in the audiences that came to libraries and museums and places that I spoke, there were just no children in the audience.
Mm.
Their parents didn't bring them, their grandparents didn't bring them. And I wanted kids, not just adults, but I wanted kids to know about this magnificent animal, the mountain goat, that I've spent 50 years of my life observing, photographing, studying, and writing about. And so it just dawned on me towards the end of that trip that I needed to write a book for kids, that I would speak directly to them, or rather the characters in my novel would, because I decided the best way to talk about what I wanted to get across, the message, was to wrap the environmental message in a grand adventure that the kids would have fun reading. And the theme that's throughout the Legend Keeper series, all three books, is how the changing climate, global warming, is affecting glaciers, the alpine environment, the high mountain environment, and the plants and animals that live there. And so, as I've written these books, the reader sees what's happening in the climate crisis through the eyes and the lives of both animals and kids. Not adults talking to them, but animals and children as they read this story. And in the process of doing that, the main characters in the story, which are an orphan female mountain goat with a weighty destiny and a 12-year-old introverted boy who becomes an environmental activist, they're the ones that really tell the story, carry the story, and they're sort of role models, I think, for kids that they'll be able to relate to. So that was how it came about. That's a little bit about the story. And these books are kind of perfect for classroom STEM learning to use for for teachers and librarians to use, but they're also great for stimulating family discussions, and they're just fun reads.
So what age group are you targeting? How young and how old?
Yeah, these are middle grade books, so we're talking about 8 to 12, 13-year-olds, 3rd to 6th grade. But then also for kids our age, too, John.
Uh-huh. And how those three books differed in their approach?
Good question. It's a continuing story. In the first book, the subtitle is The Chosen One. The main character is this orphaned female mountain goat. Her name is Buddy. And you have to read the book to find out how she ended up with the name Buddy. But it's all animal characters. And she finds out that she is the only one, once she's rescued by a wizardly raven, she finds out she's the only one who can save her mom's band of goats from a great peril that's foretold in an ancient legend. And that peril, as it's stated in the legend, is called the Great Warming. So it's about a time long ago when there was a very pronounced warming period, which there actually was following the last ice age, and how it changed the high mountains. But the legend is also a forewarning of what's happening today, and she's the one that understands that. Then in the second book and the third book, there are human characters that enter the story, because although Buddy and the other animals know that things are changing where they live, they don't know why. They're animals. But humans do. We know what causes global warming. We also know how we can fix it. So that's why I needed to have humans in the story, starting in the second book, so there could be ways to address real world, ways that people could change what's happening. And Buddy and this 12-year-old boy, Garson, end up developing a partnership.
So are they conversing, or are you just reporting on what they do? How did you go about with your characters communicating?
Well, the books are a blend of fact and fiction. Most of what I relate in there about the animals is factual. Mm. It's about their lives, and it's pretty much what actually happens. But it is fiction, and that's the beauty of fiction, is we can also write about the things we would like to know, just not what we know. And so I was able to give Buddy a superpower. And her superpower is she can talk to other species of animals, and she can talk to one small 12-year-old boy, Garson.
Interesting. So, yeah, when did you start writing that book?
The idea for it actually came about when I was doing that book tour for Life on the Rocks, The Portrait of the Mountain Goat. You know, it dawned on me then, I wanted to reach children. I wanted to reach a new and important audience, young people. They're the ones that are going to suffer the greatest consequences of climate change because they have decades of their lives ahead of them. And so that's how I thought about doing this.
How long ago was that?
That was in 2016, 17.
Okay.
No, it was before that. It was actually in 2015.
So about a decade ago.
But then I ended up writing the book Stories from a Field, that last nonfiction book. And so it kind of put off for a couple of years starting on the children's novels. So I really got going on the first one in 2017, late 17, I think.
And what kind of reaction have you gotten?
Well, the best reactions I get are when I do school visits and I get to talk with kids. And that's really been a joy. I've been spending a lot of time in classrooms. Last week was Read Across America Week, which happens the first week of March every year. Started back in 1998. And I was at three different schools last week. I talked to almost 600 children, generally assembled in their gymnasiums. And then I always leave lots of time for questions and answers. And that's been so so much fun to hear from them and then get follow-up emails from librarians with further questions that the kids have or things they want to tell me.
How far afield have you traveled to do that?
I've had a couple of virtual ones that are a ways off.
Oh.
But as far as in-person ones, I did a library visit up in Libby, Montana. I did one in Sandpoint, Idaho. I did one in Thompson Falls, Montana. Those were last year. These most recent ones have all been right in the Bozeman Valley or in Livingston, Montana.
Do you just talk or do you show pictures or how do you go about that?
Yeah, what I like to do is I like to start off with a video clip from a PBS nature special about mountain goats. And it's just a 3-minute clip that shows kid mountain goats playing. They're like a week or two old. They're playing and their mother's there. And that really gets the kids' interest right away. Because I always ask for a show of hands, and it's amazing how many kids in that 8 to 12-year-old group have never seen a mountain goat in the wild, even here in Montana. So I show them that and then talk a little bit about who I am, how I start writing the books, just like you asked me, and a little bit about the books. And I'm doing a PowerPoint presentation when I do that.
Do you do other writing at the same time that you're writing these books? Are you writing
novels? I really don't have another nonfiction project that I want to do. I still do a little bit of magazine writing. I had an article, and you might be familiar with a magazine from when you were in Montana called Distinctively Montana. Yeah, I had an article in there last year, but my focus really now is working with children, environmental education, talking to them about conservation of animals, and just for them to know more about animals, because, as you know, it's only when we care about animals that we're inclined to get involved and try and protect them, you know? Like the sixth extinction is going on, whether we like to admit it or not. It doesn't happen quickly, but it is ongoing. And so I'm just trying to sort of recruit more people into caring about nature and the variety of species we have, protecting those for ourselves and for future generations.
Well, let me ask a little bit more about mountain goats. Mountain goats are usually found at a high elevation, and so they have difficulty moving from one location to another and sharing genetic material in producing offspring. Isn't that right?
That's right.
And is that a problem in where you find mountain goats in the Rocky Mountains?
Well, that phenomenon you're referring to where you don't have gene flow among populations becomes critical when populations shrink. And so the number of breeding adults is so few, and they're more likely to be related to one another. And then we can get effects from what we call inbreeding depression.
Right.
One of the things that happens is you have poor survival. But there are other problems that can crop up, too. So species like mountain goats, which have high fidelity and tend to stay in the same, population will stay in the same area. It might migrate up and down the mountains, but its geographical range might be very similar to what it was hundreds or even thousands of years ago, and you don't get gene flow from one to another. That's when those problems crop up. And a colleague and I did a status review of Montana's mountain goats. It was published by Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. They're the ones that actually commissioned this study. It came out in 2017 or 18, I believe. It's on their website. What we found, and this was the first statewide comprehensive status survey of goats in the state in 70 years, since the 1940s. And what we found with the native populations, because Montana has both native and introduced populations east of the Continental Divide, goats have been introduced in places where they never prehistorically existed. But with the native populations, we found the number of goats has declined by almost 70%.
Oh, my.
And those kinds of declines are occurring in Idaho, in Washington, southern British Columbia, and Alberta. We don't know the reasons why for sure. We know some of the reasons that have contributed to this, but what we do know that's very troubling is once populations have declined, some of these individual populations on mountain ranges have declined, when hunting is removed, or at least greatly reduced, the populations, in many cases, are not increasing again. They're just struggling along at very low numbers.
What's a viable population number for a herd of mountain goats?
I'm not sure anyone can answer that.
Oh, okay.
One thing about mountain goats is that there has probably been less research and less written about mountain goats than any other large mammal in North America. So we still have lots of data gaps. Basic questions like that one you asked, which is a very important one, we don't really know the answer to it. But it's certainly more than, say, 50 goats. And for native populations in Montana, half of those populations only number 50 goats now or less.
Where in Montana would you find mountain goats? How far east?
Now, the native ones, you won't find them any farther east than the Rocky Mountain front. So that would be, on the east side of the Bob Marshall and the Great Bear Wilderness and the Scapegoat Wilderness. And there's one native population down in the southwest part of the state that's also just on the east side of the Continental Divide in the Pioneer Mountains. And then as we go east from there, there were never mountain goats. So we can think of all those mountain ranges like the Snowcrest and the Tobacco Roots and the Highlands and the Bridgers and the Elkhorns.
What about Roots?
The Big Belts, different ranges like this where mountain goats have been introduced. And some of the biggest populations are in the Madison, Gallatin, and Beartooth and Absarca ranges. But those were all physically goats that were captured from native populations and then brought there, transported. And that's how they were established in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Yeah. What about mountain sheep? Are they usually found in the same place you'll find mountain goats?
Sometimes. Yeah, there's definitely populations that overlap. I mean, if people go to Glacier Park, for example, where there's a healthy population of mountain goats, the native goats in Glacier are doing remarkably well relative to the ones outside the park. But if you go there and you see mountain goats, you'll also see bighorn sheep, and sometimes you can find them really close together.
Okay, well, Bruce, we have just about run out of time, but it's been very interesting, and I laud you what you're doing for young people to educate them. That's really great.
Well, thanks for the chance to talk to your audience, John, and take care of yourself out there in Washington.
Okay. Our guest today has been Bruce Smith, wildlife biologist, now retired from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and author of numerous books and articles about wildlife, including his trilogy called The Legend Keeper's Novels. So thanks again, Bruce. Good to talk with you. Adios.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.